Welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast, podcast number 7 for July 14th, 2009. I'm Ben Snitkoff, and with me today we've got
Dominic Rabier
and David O'Brien.
We've got three great stories for you this week. The first one is an ad blocker who got sued and was found immune from liability under our good friend the Communications Decency Act. The second story is that Amazon killed a iPhone application for violating its terms of service. And lastly, we've got a story involving Google, Apple, conflicts of interest, and the Clayton Antitrust Act. So we're just going to dive right into this with the AdBlock immunity case. So the background behind this case is that a company made ad blocking software. Now, this software blocked a specific application. The makers of that application sued the makers of the ad blocking and antivirus, anti-adware application, essentially for violating their terms of service and for essentially libeling their program, saying that, you know, this program's adware when the maker of the program didn't think that it was adware. This case went up to the, I believe it was the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
That's correct.
That's correct. And the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals found that this prosecution, this case was preempted, that they couldn't bring this case because the makers of the adware were protected by the Communications Decency Act. So we've talked about the Communications Decency Act before. Can one of you two give me a quick rundown of what it is in this case, and specifically how in this case it's being applied differently than in the previous cases we've talked about?
Sure. The Communications Decency Act was passed in 1996 by Congress for the broad purpose of controlling the exposure of minors to indecent material. Large provisions of it were struck down because they were in violating the First Amendment, but one provision, Section 230, survived. And that provision basically provides immunity for interactive computer servicers it provides immunity for interactive computer services from accusations of libel if they basically filter content. And this particular case deals with Section 230.2b, which says that any action taken to enable or make available to information content providers or others the technical means to restrict access to the material described in paragraph 1. And paragraph 1's material is basically anything sort of offensive. And how this differs from the other cases that we've considered is that we're looking at action taken by information content providers or others to actually restrict the material, as opposed to the other cases where we've seen that where its users have posted stuff and the information content providers aren't liable for that.
Right. Just to clear something up, I misspoke earlier. So the Ninth Circuit in this case found on they kicked out the case on what's called summary judgment, which is it's before trial, but it's not that far. There are multiple points when you can kick a case out of court. There's what's called the 12b-6, which is a dismissal on the pleadings, which is, you know, right after the person files the case, the other person can come back and say, this case doesn't belong in court, and they kick it out. In this case, there was some discovery that happened. There may have been some depositions that were taken, and it was dismissed on what's called the court had a summary judgment for the defendants in this case. Is there a better way to describe summary judgment other than saying that the judgment was summary?
Basically, yes. The facts aren't in dispute. Go for it. The facts aren't in dispute, and they can just rule right on the law. No one is complaining about the facts of the case. The facts are clear. The parties are just differing in how they interpret the law, so the court can just quickly rule on the law based on the mutually agreed facts.
And one of the parties would make a motion for summary judgment.
Right, and the party moving has the burden to prove that either there aren't any facts in dispute, or that even if there are facts in dispute, the law that can be determined is settled on this point, and that, you know, regardless of what other facts are, they're relevant based on relevant facts and the law, the case should get kicked out. So, Dominic, you mentioned that this isn't the typical case that we see. In the typical case, it's someone like, let's say, Facebook, and I libel you on Facebook. The CDA typically prevents Facebook from being liable for
So, yeah, broadly, the CDA has Section C, which is the super big title on that, is Protection for, quote, Good Samaritan Blocking and Screening of Offensive Material. And Section C has two parts. And the first part is Treatment of Publisher or Speaker. And that one basically says it's the sort of Facebook situation where Facebook wouldn't be liable for someone else saying on Facebook something bad about somebody else. Facebook can't get sued because they are a provider of interactive computer service. They're not going to be treated as the publisher or speaker. The second provision, which we haven't seen that often, and in fact, I think this is the first time the Ninth Circuit has considered the provision, Section C2, is the civil liability provision. And that basically says that no provider or user of an interactive computer service is going to be held liable on account of any good faith action taken to restrict access to material that provider or a user could consider obscene, lewd, and all, a whole list of other evil adjectives, if you will. And it also includes technical means to restrict access to that material. So basically, the big distinction is Section C1 deals with publishers and speakers, meaning that an information content service is not going to be held liable for something users say on that service, where Section 2 holds that the information content service is not going to be held liable for what it prevents users from seeing or accessing. In other words, if the information user service holds itself out and says, we're going to protect our users from seeing evil, nasty content, they're not going to get sued for preventing users from seeing evil, nasty content, even if they make a mistake, because it's a good faith, good Samaritan effort.
Right. So, David, let me throw this one to you. Based on what Dominic said, who are the parties and who's alleging who did what? You know, what's the real meat of this case?
Well, this case was actually between a company called Zango and Kaspersky, which is the other company. And most people are probably familiar with Kaspersky because they are a Russian provider of antivirus software and other tools to eliminate malware in a computer. And basically what happened was that Zango said that Kaspersky's blocking software was blocking access to certain tools which were available on their website. And because they were blocking them, it was preventing users from being able to download the Zango software. And the way that Kaspersky was classifying the Zango software was that it was saying it was malware and it was not good for your computer. And it would provide a little dialogue pop-up which said you can either allow or disallow the software download. And when users even clicked allow, the argument that Zango was presenting was that it would create a situation on the computer where a user would be unable to get rid of the Zango tools.
Okay, so what was the claim that they were raising? What was their basis for recovery? What were they saying that, you know, we
right.
know what they did, but how is that actionable? What was the harm that came?
It was framed interestingly, as a legal argument, as tortious interference of a contract. And that basically occurs when you have some sort of third party, which is not a party to a contract, and they're stepping in and sort of interfering with either the underlying rights of the contract or the subject matter of the contract. So Zango was basically saying the users are accepting the download of their software, and that is forming some sort of legally recognized agreement. And when Kaspersky steps in and says, hey, this is malware, you guys shouldn't be installing this on your computer, we're blocking it, but you can allow it or disallow it, it was basically interfering with those contractual rights, more specifically the right of the user to say, hey, it's okay, and I want the Zango software on my computer.
Okay, so what's your overall view of this? Did the court come to the right opinion here?
Well, the CDA is sort of an interesting beast. It's been used very expansively in the last 10 years or so. I believe it was actually enacted in 1996, so 13 years. And it's really been applied to provide immunity to online service providers for mostly for the content on websites, but in this case, we're talking about the filtering tools. And the court essentially sided with Kaspersky, and they said the CDA protects them here. They're allowed to do this. And I think there was a concurrence with the opinion, and it concurrence of the opinion says, yes, I agree with the, it was written by one judge, and he said, I agree with the ultimate result that under the current language of the CDA, the way that it's worded says that these things are okay for Kaspersky to step in and provide this type of filtering software. But he pointed out some interesting problems with it, and that's basically it's allowing a company to sort of engage in sometimes questionable activity which might be anti-competitive to a marketplace. And it is essentially minimizing business torts in the end of the day. I found the concurrence to be very insightful, and clearly the judge had a good working knowledge of what was going on in the end of the day. And he said, you know, as the statute's worded, we have to accept it as it is until there's some sort of legislative clarification on what should actually be protected in terms of filtering software.
Yeah, with regard to that concurrence, that provision, the blocking thing that I read earlier, material that can be that the provider or user considers to be an obscene, lewd, lascivious, filthy, excessively violent, harassing, or otherwise objectionable. And Kaspersky basically said that Zango's adware, or what it alleged to be Zango's adware, fell into that otherwise objectionable category, and Zango actually did not. It waived that argument. It didn't argue that in the case. So the court proceeded on the grounds that the software fell under the otherwise objectionable category, which, understandably, is a pretty big umbrella, because otherwise objectionable, that could mean anything. And since it's either objectionable to the provider or the user, and basically the concurrence is. Said that, well, you can, if that umbrella is so big, and since it can be otherwise objectionable to the provider, well, say Google decides to come out with a browser and they say, well, it seems like you're trying to access a Microsoft site that's otherwise objectionable to Google, so we're going to disallow that. Obviously that's a contrived example, but theoretically that could be possible in under the language of the CDA.
Right, and this isn't the first time that we've seen the Ninth Circuit be contemptuous, be a little wary of the scope of protections granted by the CDA. There was some worry that they were going to try to roll back the protections, and there's one case, I think we may have talked about it, it was the woman who sued Yahoo for, I think it was Yahoo, her ex-boyfriend had posted a questionable ad about her, and she sued them for essentially promissory estoppel. They had promised to take down this ad, and they didn't do it, and the court let that one go on. In the first draft of the opinion that was released by the court, they had alluded to the fact that they wouldn't allow these 12b6 motions, these very early on motions to dismiss the case. The court alluded to the fact that they wouldn't allow that. I learned after our podcast that they had gone, the court went back and reissued the opinion, and they took out those paragraphs clarifying their position on that, saying that, you know, 12b6 would still be available, and at least delaying some of the fears that the Ninth Circuit was looking to limit the scope of the CDA.
With regard to this case, I think the Ninth Circuit did reach the correct decision, and reading this case actually is pretty informative for me, because I hadn't actually looked in detail to the provisions of the CDA, and it turns out that the CDA defines an interactive computer service as any information service, system, or, and this is the important thing in this case, access software provider. An access software provider, it goes on to define in a different provision, a provider of software or enabling tools that either filter, screen, allow or disallow content, pick, choose, analyze, or digest content. And given that Kaspersky software was a filtering software, and given that it was accessed by multiple users because it was downloaded by anyone who wanted to use it, it fell pretty much right under what the statute defined, even though it wasn't what because it wasn't what you would typically imagine as a CDA case, and it wasn't particularly prominent in the legislative history. Zango attempted to argue in their case that, well, Congress, even though they wrote it, they didn't really mean to extend it, even though the text does sort of say it. They never talked about it on the floor, but that argument understandably failed because the text is pretty clear.
Yeah, courts are very reluctant to play the game of what Congress meant as opposed to what Congress said, although we see the Supreme Court do it a lot and not claim that they're doing it. But that's something for another day. Any last thoughts on this?
Well, I thought that this was an interesting case because it goes to show you how broadly that the CDA can be applied, and it very well might be the case that these really aren't the types of lawsuits that we want to see the CDA used in. Because to me, it seemed like that Zango had some really good arguments as to why Kaspersky was interfering with the user's right to accept their software. And unfortunately, the way that the CDA is worded right now, we sort of have to take it on its literal face, and the statute is excluding this, and there isn't good evidence of the intent of Congress in terms of this area. So there aren't really a whole lot of arguments saying that, well, Congress really never intended it to be applied this way. But at the same time, here we are, and the literal reading basically requires us to do that, so we have to take it as it is and see what happens in the future.
Good points all around. The next case we have is one, it's a program that I use. It's called Delicious Library. It's a program for the Mac that is essentially, it keeps a track of all of your books, DVDs, CDs, power tools even. It's by an independent software developer by the name of Will Shipley. He made an iPhone application and used the Amazon API. So, backtracking a second. The desktop software uses something called the Amazon Product Advertising API, Application Programmer Interface. So when you put a new book into your desktop program, it goes to Amazon and it downloads a bunch of information about that book, and it stores all of the information about that book on your computer. Now, Will Shipley made a iPhone version of Delicious Library, and what the iPhone version does is it syncs up with your desktop computer, and it downloads all of the information from your desktop onto your iPhone. Now, what Mr. Shipley didn't realize when he was making this is that Amazon's product advertising API contains a prohibition against using any of that information in any type of... let me quote the language from their API. You cannot use it in connection with any site or application designed or intended for use with a mobile phone or other handheld device. So Amazon went to Apple and told Apple to take down the program. And Apple obliged, and Will Shipley, in a storm of tweets, explained this as best as he could to his fans, who were very mad that they could no longer obtain this program through the iTunes App Store. So what are we dealing with here? I thought data wasn't copyrightable.
Well, it's not. Well, certain types of data certainly are not. Again, as we've covered in almost every podcast now, copyright protects original expression that's fixed in some sort of tangible medium. And where you have data that constitutes certain types of facts, it's essentially not protectable under copyright. So there are certain things, though, I think, that in the broad definition of data that we're using here probably do qualify for copyright protection. That would include text, pictures, some of the audio, if there's any audio that's taken from Amazon, logos, and so on and so forth. Those would still fall within the protection under copyright.
But the cover of a book, let's say this thing, the program downloaded a cover of the book off of Amazon's website. Amazon doesn't own the copyright for the cover of the book. The owner of the book, the publishing company, probably owns the copyright on that.
I think you're right. Correct. Probably what's happened is that Amazon has actually been, they have some sort of license agreement, or they've been authorized to use the copyright of, to the extent that the cover of a book would be considered copyrightable. Amazon's probably been authorized to use and replicate copies of the arrangement on the front of the book.
So to provide a little more background on this case, basically the Amazon product advertising API is a relatively new thing that came out. If you remember back in the day, there used to be this thing called the Amazon Associates program, where you could create links to books on Amazon, and then if people bought books through your links, then you could get a share of the profit. That used to be done manually back in the late 90s, and basically the product advertising API was born out of that to help people automate that, like, so you didn't have to code every link manually, and they launched the product advertising API. So what they're, and when you sign up as a developer with Amazon and say, I want to use your API, which is an application programming interface, to access your data, you do agree to this contract. So it's not really a question of copyright law. It's more a question of contract law. And Amazon does say in their contract that you won't create something that's primarily used for a mobile application without our permission first. And there is a little link there you can request their permission, and they can grant it or not grant it. I'm not sure about the timeline on this case. From what I understood, Shipley built the application and then realized he needed to ask permission and then asked permission and was denied. I don't think he asked permission before starting to build.
No, I think that's correct. It was after he found out about... Actually, it was after Apple had killed this application in the App Store, I think.
Yeah, and for the record, it was released. I do, in fact, have a copy of it on my iPhone, which I will never delete, just to, you know, stick it to Amazon. I had a question a second ago. Oh, right. So a couple of weeks ago, we talked about a case where Yahoo was suing the NFL Players Association. So Yahoo had previously entered into a contract for permission to use NFL players' names and statistics in use with their fantasy football league. And then at the same time, we also discussed whether or not you can copyright data. So if the data... you know, just the facts about these books and things aren't copyrightable. So break it down to me why he's bound to this contract if what's being protected isn't what the subject of the contract isn't necessarily protected by copyright.
All right, the subject of the contract is not the information about the books, which is not copyrightable, or which, if it is copyrightable, isn't exclusive to Amazon. He could go and get a contract with every other... I mean, there's nothing stopping him from writing to every other publisher of every book and saying, I'd like to take a picture of your book and use it in my program. Nothing is stopping him from doing that. However, Amazon has pretty much already done that, and they have all the images and all the data in nice one convenient location, and they provide this convenient application programming interface. However, to use this product advertising API... you have to agree to their contract, which one of the provisions that they put in is, we don't want you to create a mobile application without our permission, likely because Amazon made an acquisition a couple months ago of a company that looks like it's going to try to make its own sort of mobile thing. So perhaps Amazon wants to work in this space itself and doesn't want a competitor coming in and using its own API to build something earlier before it can get its own product out there.
Dave, you were trying to jump in a second ago?
Yeah, that's a great read, Dominic. I do sort of disagree on some certain points. I think that certain things that are being taken by the Delicious Library probably do fall within copyrightable subject matter, and because Amazon is, we can assume as much, that they have been authorized to use those certain copyrightable elements, that they can also relicense them out to other people. And if you want to use this API, then you have to agree to this terms of service agreement in the end of the day. I do think that the underlying subject matter is partially copyrightable subject matter and partially uncopyrightable subject matter. And when you get down to the fine points of that, it would really depend on like fact-specific, you know, case-by-case sort of evaluations. If we were talking about a certain book, it would depend on what exactly was taken. Now, if what's being lifted off of Amazon's site includes some of the book descriptions in their original expression, I think that certainly qualifies as copyrightable subject matter. Mm-hmm. In any event, what has happened here is, you, as Dominic correctly characterized, is that Amazon is authorized to use these pictures, logos, text, and other types of data, and they are reauthorizing it out to other people to access their website and take down the data.
Okay, so does Mr. Shipley have any arguments as to, you know, is there some other force of law that could come in and protect him from, you know, to at least allow him to be able to use some or all of this information?
Well, he doesn't have to use Amazon's API, I mean, to do what he wants to do. He could go to Barnes & Noble and say, hi, do you guys have an API? If not, can you come up with one and can I use yours? I don't know if Barnes & Noble has an API, personally. With any other contractual dispute, I mean, Amazon, they built this API. They make it available. They run the servers that provide responses. But legally, with regard to using Amazon's API, I don't see any sort of legal avenue that he could use.
Well, he could try to. This is a horribly thin argument. I think it's very interesting on an academic scale. It's been debated a lot by commentators and law professors and law review articles and journals and such, but it has not been accepted in a court of law yet. And as I get back to sort of my underlying point here, is that there's some copyrightable subject matter and some not copyrightable subject matter. He might try to argue that the license agreement by itself is preempted by federal law, and that certain provisions within the license agreement therefore are unenforceable. And my point when I draw this out is that copyright law has limitations on it. So the holder of a copyright doesn't have totally expansive rights to bar anybody from using. We've talked about this before. It's called fair use. And the Copyright Act itself has the fair use provisions in it. And what the license is essentially doing is eliminating certain types of fair use rights. You could argue that by accessing some of this data, specifically the copyrightable data, it could be a fair use just to take it down off the site and put it onto a onto the desktop, and then from onto the desktop onto the mobile phone. And that would sort of fly in the face of the federal goals of the Copyright Act. Now, preemption, sort of a very nuanced doctrine. It's very complicated, but there's two different types of preemption arguments you could try to raise. Essentially, there's express preemption. That's where a statute actually has a provision in it that says Congress intends this area to be preempted, so meaning that states cannot enforce it. And we're also dealing with two areas of law here. We're dealing with contract law and we're dealing with copyright law. And so the argument is sort of that the state enforcement of a contract obligation is essentially running in the face of what Congress or what the Federal Copyright Act is trying to do, the things that Congress has enacted. And the second argument is implied preemption, and this goes more to what I was just talking about, and that's where you have a state-enforced right that is sort of at odds with a particular federal statute. And so you could argue that the license then, because it is eliminating this type of fair use, it does not comply with the Federal Copyright Act, and therefore that particular provision should not be enforced. But like I said before, no court has really accepted this, certainly not in the whole. It's been brought up a lot in the context of end-user license agreements, or EULAs, and I think we've talked about that a little bit before in the past. But nonetheless, it's still an interesting argument. It's not a very financially feasible argument. It would take a lot of money to challenge the Amazon license in the end of the day, and probably not one that Mr. Shipley is likely to do. Yeah, there's two other interesting arguments I could talk about if you want. Separately, there's these other interesting arguments about whether or not you could even use a license to protect unprotectable subject matter in a license, unprotectable copyright subject matter in a license. Essentially, the argument is that the Copyright Act lays out what is copyrightable subject matter, and it doesn't protect certain things. And as we sort of noted, that there are certain parts of what's available on Amazon.com which would probably not fall under copyrightable subject matter. But what the license is essentially doing is it's creating a legal remedy for using that type of unprotectable subject matter without authorization. And so essentially you could also make a preemption argument that the license should be preempted because it is basically protecting areas of law which federal law has designated not to be protected. Again, another very nuanced and almost academic discussion going on here, and it hasn't really been accepted practically in any court, but fun to talk about still.
Right, and part of the reason, not to sell your argument short, part of the reason it hasn't been accepted by any courts is that, to the best of my knowledge, no one's raised it at any type of serious challenge at this point.
Well, there has been challenges that have been raised over the last 5 or 6 years, and to some extent people have argued that cases like Apple v. SciStar should potentially raise some of those issues, even though they're not really at issue right now in the lawsuit. There was the ProCD case, which was probably the biggest one, and that was in the Seventh Circuit by Judge Easterbrook, who famously penned the opinion, which almost gave blanket protection to these types of license agreements, and it sort of cut short all of the preemption arguments. But they were brought before the court. They were just not recognized as viable under the court's eyes. And the justification that Judge Easterbrook put forward was that basically the contracting law is very broad and expansive, and parties can contract to whatever they want to. And when you have two parties like here, you always have a, one person could always walk away from the agreement and say, hey, I don't want to do this. So they're not bound to the agreement. And that's sort of what makes it different than copyright law, because copyright law is a right against the world, whereas a contract is just an agreement between two or more people
right,
that agree to the license.
Right. That was going to be my last point, that part of the problem here is that there are very few rights that you cannot contract away. Those rights are so few and far between that it's a hard argument to make that federal copyright law would preempt this when, so many other rights are...
Biggest point, I think Dominic has already hit on it, is that there are other ways to get this sort of data, and, Shipley is freely available to go off and try to make other arrangements to find the data, but under the terms of the license agreement, the conditions that Amazon has set forth do not allow for him to do it in this way, and they've denied him some sort of accommodation to the contrary, so there really isn't very much that he can do at this point. And like I said, I don't think that the preemption argument holds any weight in this case. It's usually much different when we're talking about other types of software, but certainly not here where it's available through other means.
Right, and when we say freely available, it's worth noting that it would put a significant cost burden on Mr. Shipley to essentially rewrite his entire program or rewrite large sections of his program to get data from a new source. Delicious Library has been out for a very long time. It's in its second version now. So
I hate to say it, though. This is pretty much his fault, since he wasn't aware of this provision in the license agreement. And that should be the first thing you do when you try to build a business model off of something like this, where you know that there are some sort of terms of use agreement at issue. You need to go in and you need to find out if what you're trying to do is even permissible under, the terms that a company like Amazon is providing the data.
Well, when he wrote the first version of this, the iPod Touch, the iPhone, didn't exist. It wasn't even a glimmer in anyone's eye. Mobile computing was not nearly where it was now. And furthermore, there's nothing to say. I haven't tracked the history of the Amazon product API. It may have been a very different API when he first started using it, and Amazon just kept on changing the terms of service, and he
could
had no choice. That would be an interesting argument.
Maybe, but you know what? In the end of the day, he's still allowed to use the Delicious Library, correct, as I'm reading the terms here. It's just he's not allowed to port it over to a mobile device.
Right, he can, but I just want to spin out this argument so that the listeners can hear it. The argument would be that he started using this. He built a product based on this, and then Amazon changed the terms of service of the product. And there'd be some amount of – it would be a difficult argument to make, but you could argue that, he was – it wouldn't be duress. It would be something like unconscionability, where he had invested so much into the product that he had no choice but to accept these changes of terms of service, which created an unfair bargaining position, which made him, have to agree to whatever they said, which is what's called procedural unconscionability in contracts. And usually for an unconscionability argument, you have to have both procedural unconscionability, which is a lack of balance in the parties, one party having much more power in the agreement than the other party. And then you also have to have substantive unconscionability, which is, a really onerous term. And I wouldn't call this onerous, but, that argument exists. And there are some jurisdictions that have eliminated one of those two requirements for finding a contract unconscionable. Unless there are any other thoughts, we'll move on to the last story.
Sounds good.
Crickets. Okay, so the last story is Eric Schmidt, Chrome OS, Google, Apple. So one of the big stories this past week was that Google was going to be releasing something called Chrome OS. And it's an operating system based on the Google Chrome browser. Very few details exist about this, but this raises a question that was lingering before. So Eric Schmidt, is he president or CEO or both of Google?
He is both.
He is the president and CEO of Google, also sits on the Apple board, and Apple and Google have had...
Actually, I'm sorry, just to clarify, he's not the president, he's the chairman and CEO.
Okay, sorry, the chairman and CEO of the of Google. He sits on the Apple board, and Apple and Google have had a fairly long relationship of cooperating and doing some fairly interesting things together. Once Google released the... G1, well, Google released the Android operating system. It started to raise some questions about conflicts of interest between Google with their Android operating system and Apple with their iPhone operating system. And these questions were raised again once Google released their Chrome OS. There's some, I'd say, two or three interesting parts that this brings up. So the first is conflicts of interest in board members. They're called directorates of corporations. Raise your hand if you're an expert on corporations. Either of you two?
Well, not an expert, but I have some experience.
Okay, David, take us away on that one.
Well, basically, every corporation has a board of directors, and then you also have a layer below that. You have the officers and managers of the corporation, and then aside from that, you also have the shareholders. So those are the sort of the three most important bodies. And the directors essentially oversee... certain aspects of a corporation, and in part they're overseeing what the officers are doing. So when we talk about the CEO, the chief executive officer, that's one of the officers. Usually you have a treasurer, you also have a, in some cases, a vice president, you have a CFO, a chief financial officer, and so on and so forth. And a corporation can name as many officers as they like. They can create new officer positions. Anyways, directors owe certain duties to the shareholders in the end of the day. So basically, because when you're a shareholder of a publicly held corporation, you're basically a part owner of a corporation, depending on how many shares that you own. The directors of a corporation owe them a duty of loyalty and certain other duties too.
I'm going to jump in for a second, David.
Shoot.
Just to clarify, they owe the corporation a duty of loyalty and a duty of acting in good faith. They don't owe that duty directly to the shareholders.
Oh, thank you. I'm sorry. I botch that a little bit. But essentially, certain duties are actually owed by the directors. And one of the most important aspects of this is that since the directors are overseeing a lot of these aspects of the corporation, they need to make sure that they are acting in to a certain level of good faith, and that they are essentially loyal to the corporation. It's much more nuanced if you want to get into the particulars of corporate law. I welcome you to. There's a lot to it, though. But basically, one of the fine line rules is that directors generally cannot serve on two separate boards. So, meaning that they're a director on one board of directors for one corporation, and also a director on another company's board of directors, because it creates a conflict of interest between the two. So a lot of the times, directors are ratifying certain corporate actions, and they are agreeing to certain business plans that are presented by the officers, and they need to sort of be able to decide on those things and vote on those things in a way where there's no ulterior motives or no conflicts of interest. And because here we have two companies which are essentially now into some overlapping areas of business, the argument is that because Eric Schmidt serves on Google's board, and he not only just serves, he's also the chairman of Google's board and is serving separately on Apple's board, where you've got these overlapping areas of business. And so since they're competing against each other, you know, it sort of raises some questions as to whether Eric Schmidt is making decisions properly at this point. He sort of might become what we call an interested director, and so he should probably shield himself from certain types of votes and stuff. That's sort of the basics of this.
From what I understood, when Apple came out with the iPhone and Apple came out with the iPhone and then Google announced its Android phone operating system, Eric Schmidt said that he would be recusing himself from board discussions of the iPhone because it was necessarily competing with the Google Android system. Couldn't he then just recuse himself from discussions of OS X? I mean, if Chrome OS even competes with OS X, considering that Chrome OS is targeted towards netbooks and netbooks alone?
Well, as of today, it's still vaporware, and we don't really know what's going to happen. That's just what Google has said. They haven't, I think Ben mentioned that it had been released. The only thing that has been released up to this point is basically a press report. They are targeting for bringing this to market sometime, I think, in the second half of 2010.
Right, but I mean, from the perspective of Apple, I mean, Eric Schmidt is on their board, and he may know what Google will do, but then he gets to hear all about what Apple plans to do with its operating system.
Right. Right. I think you actually bring up a valid point there, Dominic, in that it's not just Eric Schmidt having to recuse himself from talks about netbooks, like you suggested. He'd actually have to recuse himself from talks about operating systems. And if you're not talking about the iPhone, and by extension the iPod Touch, because they use the same operating system, and you're not talking about OS X, you're really not talking a whole lot about anything at Apple. You're talking about, at this point, relic iPods, the iPod Classic and the iPod Nano, and you're talking about the desktop hardware. You're talking about the iMac and the tower. I mean, there's
maybe
got
the iTunes Store too.
Maybe the iTunes Store. Although Google has a competing app store on the Android, so just the music store.
Yes, just the music.
So you got to be wondering what's Eric Schmidt going to be doing on the board if he can't talk about it.
It's hard to deny that this is not a. It's hard to say that this isn't a core aspect of Apple's business model. On the end of the day, I think it absolutely qualifies.
Because the text of the appropriate provision in the U.S. code is that no person shall at the same time serve as director or officer in any two corporations that are, by virtue of their business and location of operation, competitors. So
well,
that the elimination
up.
Of competition by agreement between them would constitute a violation of any antitrust law.
Yeah, wait. Sorry, let's just back up for a second.
Sure.
There's actually two areas of law that this is covered under. The first is corporate law, and that's state-specific. So every corporation actually incorporates in a particular state. In this case, Google is a Delaware corporation, and Apple is a California corporation. So separately, those two companies are subject to the laws of the states that they've incorporated in. And within the statutes that cover corporations in both of those states, there are provisions which basically speak to this. And then separately, there's this antitrust issue, and I think Ben also knows a lot about this, too.
Yes. So Dominic kind of jumped to that. That's part of what's called the Clayton Act. It's an act that came after the Sherman Antitrust Act. And Dominic started to read the relevant provision that you can't serve as a director or an officer. Directors would be members of the board. Officers would be president, treasurer, CEO, CFO, positions like that. For any two companies that are engaged in whole or part in commerce and that compete with each other. And there are a few other provisions which I think are very relevant here. So first, if either of the corporations have profits under $10 million, the act doesn't apply. And that's not the case here. Both of them have profits well over $10 million every year. But for the act goes on to say that not only must the products compete, there have to be competitive sales. And the competitive sales have to be, looks like, over $1 million. Yeah. So I'm not sure.
The competitive sales of either corporation have to be. It basically says the act doesn't apply if the competitive sales of either corporation are less than $1 million.
Right. So Google gives away Android for free.
Correct.
Right. Okay. And from what we know, Google will also give Chrome OS away for free. So it's possible that these antitrust acts don't apply. What I think is an interesting question is if Chrome OS ends up being at least partially ad-supported,
right?
Then, will this kick in once the ad revenue gets over $1 million? Or, how does that count if they're not competing for sales, but they're competing for revenue?
Well, I think that's the argument that someone challenging this would certainly make. That
the law goes on, or go ahead, David.
No, that's okay. I mean, in the end of the day, that you've got something that is supported by some form of revenue, even though it's not directly by selling the operating system itself, it's still generating revenue in other avenues.
And all I was going to comment was the law actually goes on to say that competitive sales means gross revenues for all products and services sold by one corporation in competition with the other. It's based on revenues. So, ad revenue would fall into competitive sales, even though it was given away for free. at least as I understand it.
That's interesting, and I'm almost sure there's never been a case on this, but I have not, you know, tracked this back to see if anyone has determined whether or not sales from ad revenues for online-related products count.
But a good question, then. If Android is being given away for free, why did Eric Schmidt say that he would recuse himself from discussions about the iPhone during Apple's board meetings, just out of proprietary?
That's where you fall under the state corporate laws.
Ah, yes.
Okay. That's why it's important to remember that there's two separate areas of law.
Right. David has a good point that, you know, even if they're not liable under for violating the Clayton Antitrust Act, the shareholders could still bring suit saying that Eric Schmidt was violating his duty of loyalty to Google by sitting in on these, or just the opposite. The shareholders of Apple could sue saying that Google Schmidt wasn't being loyal to Apple by working on Android with Google. And I think either of those two, if he didn't recuse himself, would be very valid arguments to make. Any more points on this?
No, it makes me very nervous that he sits both on these both of these boards, mostly because in some cases the directors are allowed to access very sensitive information from both companies. If I was a shareholder in either of those companies, I would certainly be a little worried about that. Just because you don't know where a company's going to head in the future, and maybe, you know, it's totally the case that Google just targets netbooks in the end of the day, but, you know, people have said for years now that Apple's going to come out with some sort of tablet computing device or something that would rival some of the other netbooks, and, you know, you just don't know where something is going to go, and you don't want to have somebody in a position that has access to both types of information which might benefit one or the other, and I certainly think that we'll probably be hearing more about this as this sort of gets brought up. I think that there was at least one article on CNET that brought this up about Eric Schmidt possibly recusing himself from certain meetings, but it didn't seem like at this point he had really recused himself from all that many meetings. I think it's going to be brought up and something's going to happen. He's either going to step down as a board member from Apple, or you're going to see some sort of screening process.
Right. So I'd like to thank you all for listening to the Technically Legal podcast. If you want to reach us, you can email us at podcast@technicallylegal.org or visit the website www.technicallylegal.org. So signing off, I'm Ben Snitkoff.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
And I'm David O'Brien.
Thank you for listening.